Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On part two of this special three-part conversation, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Berkeley Law professor and progressive education choice icon, Stephen Sugarman. The two discuss Sugarman's 2017 essay in the Journal of Law and Religion arguing in favor of the constitutionality of faith-based charter schools. Sugarman walks us through the history of notable Supreme Court cases litigating choice funding, such as Locke v. Davey and Trinity Lutheran v. Comer, cases that set the stage for the landmark 2020 Espinoza decision. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Let's talk about your 2017 article in the Journal of Law and Religion. It was a fairly bold piece of writing in which you articulated a rationale for why you thought faith-based charter schools would be constitutional. Why don't we talk a little bit about the argument you made in that piece, and then we'll talk about the recent Espinoza piece and how that all might fit together. But let's start about your rationale in your 2007 Law Review piece.
Okay. So there was, at that time, a standing of precedent from the United States Supreme Court in a case called Locke against Davey involving the state of Washington. Washington had a program, like a number of states have, where they helped certain people fund their college education. They had a young man who wanted to go to be trained to be a minister at a college, and Washington refused to support him, even though they were supporting other people. He sued, and the United States Supreme Court originally decided, they said, well, we cannot support him because if we supported him, this would be aid to religion, and aid to religion violates the First Amendment of the Federal Constitution. Now, the Federal Constitution has these very important First Amendment. It's the Free Speech Clause, the Right of Assembly, the Right of Press, and also the Religion Clause. But there are two clauses. One is the government may not establish religion. The other, the government may not prevent people from exercising their religious freedom. So the Established Religion Clause, they had used, quite understandably, to strike down various efforts in the past to aid religious education. When New York and Pennsylvania sought to bail out Catholic schools, the Supreme Court struck that down. Direct aid to the schools or the teachers, they said you couldn't do that. That violates the Establishment Clause. So Washington's officials said, hey, look, it would violate the Establishment Clause if we gave this fellow a scholarship to go to be trained. And the United States Supreme Court said, no, actually it wouldn't, because the money was going to him, and he was going to get a choice of where he wanted to use it. And he could use it for the kind of education he wanted. And it was higher education, it wasn't K-12 education. Anyway, whatever, they made this distinction. So Washington, they sent it back to Washington, and Washington said, well, that's all very nice. We're still not gonna help him, because we don't wanna aid his religious education, even if we may be permitted to do so. We don't want to do so. And plus, we have a provision in our state constitution which seems to block that, which I'll talk more about later. So the suit goes up again to the Supreme Court. He says, this violates my religious freedom to pick me out because I'm religious, because I want a religious schooling, and deny me the scholarship. That's discrimination on the basis of religion. It violates the Free Exercise Clause. And since the court already said it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause, I should be able to get the scholarship. And the United States Supreme Court in Locke against Davey, an opinion written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, who's a conservative judge, said, no, actually, it doesn't violate the religious freedom clause because there should be, and this was his memorable phrase, there should be play in the joints. There should be some room between what's forbidden by the Establishment Clause and what's required by the Free Exercise Clause. That states ought to be able to be even more religious separation oriented than national government if they want to be. They don't have to be, of course, but if they choose to be, there ought to be some discretion for the states to cut it the way they think is appropriate as to where to draw the line between free exercise violation and establishment violation. It shouldn't be decided by judges, it shouldn't be decided by the federal constitution, it should be decided by state political men. And this was accomplished, he said, by giving their play in the joints between the two clauses. So we have this case lock against Davy. I am now confronted with this problem that the states have chosen with respect to charter school. Every state that has a charter school plan, and that's more than 40 states have charters, that these did not expressly prohibits them from being faith-based schools. And they would justify this, at least in part, on the ground, well, there's play in the joints. We have a right to be, we might be able to include charter schools, but we don't want to. And it's the discretion we have within the play in the joints. That's what they say. So they also might argue that, hey, it violates the Establishment Clause to include them anyway. So I argued, first of all, that it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause, that we saw from Locke against Davy, that if you're basically funding school choice, and the court had then decided in the interim, the Cleveland School Voucher case, where they said funding families to make choice, funding choice like that, where there's a range of choices, including religious and non-religious choices, it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. The first thing I tried to demonstrate was that it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause to include faith-based charter schools in the charter school program. Now, charter schools themselves are a very ambiguous kind of institution. Charter schools came about in Minnesota. As I said, Jack Koons and I had earlier on proposed the very same idea that they'd be, what do we mean by this? That they'd be publicly funded. Anybody can go who wants to go, and if there's more people wanting to go than there's room for, you admit by lottery. There's no selective admissions, public funding, and no tuition. So that makes them very different from private schools. On the other hand, it's also different from public schools, because public schools aren't funded in the same way centrally like this. They also, in any event, they don't have lottery admissions like this usually. Anyway, they're some sort of new creature. And the most important thing is that charter schools are largely organized, visioned, organized, and run by private actors. They're not run by public officials. They're run by sometimes not profit organizations, but other one, whatever, education management organizations, different kinds of groups that think, aha, we can offer a good education to private actors. And if we meet the charter school rules, we can then get public funding as long as we agree to the charter's terms and as long as we agree to lottery admission if we have excess demand. So they say, yeah, we want to do that because we want to. And in fact, as we've seen the charter school world develop, it's now something like 6% of all children in America go to charter schools. And these charter schools, they disproportionately serve low-income children. You don't start a charter school usually out in the rich suburbs because people are happy with their public schools. You start them in inner cities where people are not happy with how their schools are doing and they want something else, and the alternatives they have don't work for them. Now, you in Florida, you have Step Up for Students. You have 100,000 kids in private schools who couldn't afford to go otherwise. That's fabulous. But we don't have that anywhere else in the country, anything nearly like that. So the idea, okay, charter schools would be a way in which people could get choices. But the determination was made that they couldn't be faith-based schools. And I said, look, it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. We've seen that in Locke against Davy, the original, earlier version of Locke against Davy. We've seen that in the Cleveland Voucher Plan. The fact that the money goes directly to the charter school, that's just form over substance.
Right.
The reality is that you're funding choice, and that funding choice should not violate these standards. So that was the first argument. The second argument that I offered was that to refuse to do so, and this was the boldest part of the argument, would violate the free exercise clause.
Right.
The fact that you've deliberately excluded all faith-based schools from the charter school regime was religious discrimination, violating the free exercise clause. Now notice, I didn't argue that there was a constitutional right to a voucher to go to a conventional private school or a conventional faith-based private school. I didn't argue that. But I said that here, once you've chosen to have charter schools, this new form of governance, this new form of schools, that then pick out religious schools and exclude them from participating as long as they are willing to participate on the terms that other schools participate in when they are charter schools. They have to be willing to do that. They want to be charter schools. That's certain conditions. Usually you have to give standardized tests. There's usually very little curriculum control, though. That's the most important thing. The teaching style, the teaching substance is left the school. That makes it allowed for distinctive charter schools. That's privately initiated. Anyway, we said faith-based schools that are willing to do that should be able to. So we also pointed out that the reality is that we were beginning to get on the fringe of the charter school movement what is a practical matter for faith-based charter schools. You might have an Armenian community where they're members of the same faith. They decide the public schools aren't serving their kids very well. They create a charter school. Now, the charter school is not a religious school. There's no crosses, there's no religious paraphernalia around the school, there's no religious instruction, there's no prayer. It's not a religious school. But during the day, the kids are excused for an hour each day to go across the street, down the hall, to the church, to where they get religious instruction. This is permitted, this sort of release time arrangement is permitted by the United States Supreme Court. And that's where they, but the reality, of course, then is that overwhelmingly the attendees at these schools will be Armenian members of this local church. And they'll be getting regular education, which is what they want for their kids. And they'll also be getting religious education. They'll be getting it in kind of separate pieces. It's interesting, if you go to Utah, where you have a very heavy Mormon community, you see much of the same in a different format. If you go to Orem or Provo, which are important cities outside of Salt Lake, which are dominated by Mormons in Utah, kids go to school, regular public schools. And then, like at 10 o'clock, the bell rings, and the 10th graders or the 6th graders or the 3rd graders leave, and they walk across the street to the sanctuary where they get Mormon instruction. If you're not a Mormon, of course, you don't go. You get to do art or study hall or recreation or something else. But for the Mormon kids, they get to have, or they're forced by their families to have, religious education. So this isn't technically a Mormon school, but really, these are Mormons getting through public funding what they want for their children. What they want for their children is both a good education grounding in reading, writing, and arithmetic, and they want Mormon education, right? So we said, you know, we have in various ways this kind of religious congregation. Anyway, let's be open about it. Let's let religious schools apply to be charter schools and be funded like other charter schools, and if they want to operate like other charter schools, they will naturally, of course, disproportionately attract members of their own faith. I'm not denying that. Now, of course, others who are not faith members, who might find the education, their secular education, very attractive, might choose to go there, and they have every right to choose to opt to the school, and they have to be allowed to enter there. So I think that the schools have to be willing to abide by that. So that's part of their, that'd be part of the conditions of being the chartered faith-based charter. So I argued that it was unconstitutional. Just as I finished my article, the United States Supreme Court decided the Trinity Lutheran case. This turned out to be a big deal case for me, because although it's involved the paving of a school, of a preschool, of playgrounds with ground-up tires. The state of Missouri had a lot of extra tires, apparently, that they environmentally were recycling. And the system in which preschools could apply and compete for this year's allocation of the ground-up tire paving program. And they picked 20 schools of the many preschools that applied. They said, the winners, we're going to come and pave your parking lot. And then they discovered that one of the schools that they picked out was a church-based preschool. And they said, oops, we can't do that. We don't want to aid religion in any event. Our state law prevents us from aiding religion, and this would be aid to religion, even though it would be paving a preschool playground. And They said, we're not going to do it. They first said it would violate the Establishment Clause, and they also said, in any event, because of the play in the joints, we ought to have the right to choose not to include them in the program. And the United States Supreme Court in the Trinity Lutheran case said this complete barring of religious preschools from the program was a discrimination on the basis of religion, violated the Free Exercise Clause. And it was a denial of religious schools having a chance just for playground repaving to be equally treated. This decision was 7-2. Only Ginsburg and Sotomayor dissented. Breyer went along with the decision and said, hey, come on, it's paving a preschool parking playground. This is not establishing religion. This is not violating the... And they ought to have a chance to get their playgrounds paved as well. So the Supreme Court said that. Now that, of course, fell right in line with my argument that when you have these faith-based organizations that are willing to comply with rules designed for the promotion of secular things like, my case, elementary and secondary education, their case, preschool education, although this was the playground for the preschool, they ought to have a chance to get access to state funding in the same way that other entities, other private, because these other private preschools were able to get access. They were like the other charter schools. And why can't the faith-based preschools have a chance as well? The Supreme Court said they had a right. They didn't really, in Trinity Lutheran, pay a lot of attention to the implications of Davey against Locke and the play in the joints. They didn't do that. They basically said, come on, this is outrageous that you deny them access to chance to have their playgrounds paved. It's a religious discrimination. They didn't think about it as an education case. And so that, I included a brief discussion of Trinity Lutheran at the end of my article to say this very much supports my argument, although charter schools are not exactly the same as these preschools. These preschools, after all, are widely understood to be private. And charter schools are ambiguous as to whether, as I said from earlier, whether they're public or private. They're described as public in the statute. They're often call themselves public charter schools, the ones that exist. But they're run by private parties, just like those preschools, which are doing a public service, a public function of educating kids and caring for kids before they go to kindergarten, and they're doing it privately initiated. They're certainly a public entity in many respects, but they're viewed as private. So what are they exactly? Charter schools have this ambiguity. And I think if Justice O'Connor were still on the court, she would ask, well, what does the average person think about this? Do they think of charter schools as being public schools or private schools? And the problem is that it's ambiguous as to what people think. It used to be that they were talked about much more as public schools. But now the teachers' unions have become very hostile to charter schools, and they describe them all the time as private schools, which in many ways, but not always, they are. Because why? Because they're run by private, managed by, and promoted by private parties who govern their operations. Anyway, the point is that this could potentially make a difference. Nonetheless, I made my argument that should not turn on that. It should turn on the functional reality that these are privately initiated educational enterprises. And if other private parties can come forward, after all, charter schools are not schools, generally speaking, that are started by public school districts.
Right.
But public school districts want choice. They start magnet schools. They start alternative schools. They have their own internally managed, run by them, choice options for families. And there's a lot more families who go to those magnet and alternative schools, public schools, now. They don't start charter schools. What they do is they accept applications by private parties to create new schools, schools to participate in this program. Many school districts are not excited about having charter schools. Here in Berkeley, California, there's a great hostility to charter schools. But in Oakland, where I live, they're very supportive traditionally of charter schools. We've got more than 30 charter schools in Oakland. So different localities have different attitudes towards it. But that's why charter schools are able to be chartered not only by local districts, which are the main charters, but also by often some other agencies, maybe public universities. universities, maybe the State Board of Education, maybe the County Board of Education outside the South. We have separate county education level governance. In Arizona, there's a separate chartering only. That's our only job is to charter schools, state organization. So there are different ways in which people can get charters besides getting the cooperation of their local community and school district. Anyway, we have now a large number of charter schools, some thousands. The question is, should faith-based schools be able to be included? Or should states be able to, through the so-called play in the joints, reject and say, no, we want more separation of church and state, and that would be too much connection between, either because we believe that it would be too much involvement with religion, or because we have some state constitutional provision which prevents us